caused bitterness. The final capture of the state's capital by carpetbaggers, Yankees, and Negroes caused an intensity of bitterness such as the state had never known before. Atlanta and Georgia seethed and raged. And Rhett Butler was a friend of the hated Bullock. Scarlet, with her usual disregard for all matters not directly under her nose, had scarcely known an election was being held. Rhett had taken no part in the election, and his relations with the Yankees were no different from what they had always been. But the fact remained that Rhett was a scalawag and a friend of Bullock. And if the marriage went through, Scarlet also would be turning scalawag. Atlanta was in no mood to be tolerant or charitable toward anyone in the enemy camp, and the news of the engagement coming when it did, the town remembered all of the evil things about the pair and none of the good. Scarlet knew the town was rocking, but she didn't realize the extent of public feeling until Mrs. Merriweather, urged on by her church circle, took it upon herself to speak to her for her own good. "Because your own dear mother is dead and Miss Pitty, not being a matron, is not qualified to... to talk to you upon such a subject. I feel that I must warn you, Scarlet. Captain Butler is not the kind of a man for any woman of good family to marry. He is a... He managed to save Grandpa Merriweather's neck and your nephew's, too." Mrs. Merriweather swelled. Hardly an hour before, she had had an irritating talk with Grandpa. The old man had remarked that she must not value his hide very much if she didn't feel some gratitude to Rhett Butler, even if the man was a scallywag and a scoundrel. "He only did that as a dirty trick on us all, Scarlet, to embarrass us in front of the Yankees," Mrs. Merriweather continued. "You know as well as I do that the man is a rogue. He always has been, and now he's unspeakable. He is simply not the kind of man decent people receive." "No? That's strange, Mrs. Merriweather. He was in your parlor often enough during the war. And he gave Maybelle her white satin wedding dress, didn't he? Or is my memory wrong? Things were so different during the war, and nice people associated with many men who were not quite... It was all for the cause, and very proper, too. Surely you can't be thinking of marrying a man who wasn't in the army, who jeered at men who did enlist... He was, too, in the army. He was in the army 8 months. He was in the last campaign and fought at Franklin and was with General Johnston when he surrendered. "I had not heard that," said Mrs. Merriweather, and she looked as if she didn't believe it either. "But he wasn't wounded," she added triumphantly. "Lots of men weren't. Everybody who was anybody got wounded. I know no one who wasn't wounded." Scarlet was goaded. "Then I guess all the men you knew were such fools they didn't know when to come in out of a shower of rain, or of mini-balls. Now let me tell you this, Mrs. Merriweather, and you can take it back to your busybody friends. I'm going to marry Captain Butler, and I wouldn't care if he'd fought on the Yankee side." When that worthy matron went out of the house with her bonnet jerking with rage, Scarlet knew she had an open enemy now instead of a disapproving friend. But she didn't care. Nothing Mrs. Merriweather could say or do could hurt her. She didn't care what anyone said, anyone except Mammy. Scarlet had borne with Pitty swooning at the news and had steeled herself to see Ashley look suddenly old and avoid her eyes as he wished her happiness. She had been amused and irritated at the letters from Aunt Pauline and Aunt Eulalie in Charleston. Horror struck at the news. Forbidding the marriage, telling her it would not only ruin her social position but endanger theirs. She had even laughed when Melanie, with a worried pucker in her brows, said loyally, "Of course, Captain Butler is much nicer than most people realize, and he was so kind and clever the way he saved Ashley. And after all, he did fight for the Confederacy. But, Scarlet, don't you think you'd better not decide so hastily?" No, she didn't mind what anybody said, except Mammy. Mammy's words were the ones that made her most angry and brought the greatest hurt. I has seed you do a heap of things dat would hurt Miss Ellen, did she know? And it has done sorrowed me a plenty. But dis year is the worst yet. Marrying trash. Yes'm, I said trash. Don't go telling me he come from fine folkses. That don't make no difference. Trash come out of the high places, same as the low, and he trash. Yes'm, Miss Scarlet, I seed you take Mr. Charles away from Miss Honey when you didn't care nothing about him. And I seed you rob your own sister of Mr. Frank. And I's hushed my mouth about a heap of things you has done, like selling poor lumber for good, and lying about the other lumber gentlemen's, and riding round by yourself, exposing yourself to freed issue niggers and getting Mr. Frank shot, and not feeding them poor convicts enough to keep their souls in their bodies. I's done hushed my mouth, even if Miss Ellen in the Promised Land was saying, Mammy, Mammy, you ain't look after my child right. Yes'm. I stood for all that, but I ain't gwine stand for this, Miss Scarlet. You can't marry with trash. Not while I got breath in my body. I shall marry whom I please, said Scarlet coldly. I think you're forgetting your place, Mammy. And high time, too. If I don't say these words to you, who gwine to do it? I've been thinking the matter over, Mammy, and I've decided that the best thing for you to do is to go back to Tara. I'll give you some money and... Mammy drew herself up with all her dignity. I is free, Miss Scarlet. You can't send me nowhere I don't want to go. And when I goes back to Tara, it's gwine be when you goes with me. I ain't gwine leave Miss Ellen's child, and there ain't no way in the world to make me go. And I ain't gwine leave Miss Ellen's grandchildren for no trashy step-pa to bring up neither. Here I is, and here I stays. I will not have you staying in my house and being rude to Captain Butler. I am going to marry him, and there's no more to be said. There is plenty more to be said, retorted Mammy slowly. And into her blurred old eyes there came the light of battle. But I ain't never thought to say it to none of Miss Ellen's blood. But Miss Scarlet, listen to me. You ain't nothing but a mule in horse harness. You can polish a mule's feet and shine his hide and put brass all over his harness and hitch him to a fine carriage. But he a mule just the same. He don't fool nobody. And you is just the same. You got silk dresses and the mills and the store and the money. And you give yourself airs like a fine horse. But you a mule just the same. And you ain't fooling nobody neither. And that butler man, he come of good stock, and he all slicked up like a racehorse, but he a mule in horse harness just like you. Mammy bent a piercing look on her mistress. Scarlet was speechless and quivering with insult. If you say you gwan marry him, you gwan do it 'cause you is bullheaded like your pa. But remember this, Miss Scarlet, I ain't leaving you. I gonna stay right here and see this thing too. Without waiting for a reply, Mammy turned and left Scarlet, and if she had said, Thou shalt see me at Philippi, her tones could not have been more ominous. While they were honeymooning in New Orleans, Scarlet told Rhett of Mammy's words. To her surprise and indignation, he laughed at Mammy's statement about mules in horse harness. I have never heard a profound truth expressed so succinctly, he said. Mammy's a smart old soul and one of the few people I know whose respect and goodwill I'd like to have. But being a mule, I suppose I'll never get either from her. She even refused the $10 gold piece which I, in my groom-like fervor, wished to present her after the wedding. I've seen so few people who did not melt at the sight of cash. But she looked me in the eye and thanked me and said she wasn't a free-issue nigger and didn't need my money.
Why should she take on so?
Why should everybody gabble about me like a bunch of guinea hens? It's my own affair whom I marry and how often I marry. I've always minded my own business. Why don't other people mind theirs?
My pet, the world can forgive practically anything except people who mind their own business. But why should you squall like a scalded cat? You've said often enough that you didn't mind what people said about you. Why not prove it? You know you've laid yourself open to criticism so often in small matters, you can't expect to escape gossip in this large matter. You knew there'd be talk if you married a villain like me. If I were a low-bred, poverty-stricken villain, people wouldn't be so mad, but a rich, flourishing villain, of course, that's unforgivable. I wish you'd be serious sometimes.
I am serious. It's always annoying to the godly when the ungodly flourish like the green bay tree.
Cheer up, Scarlet. Didn't you tell me once that the main reason you wanted a lot of money was so you could tell everybody to go to hell? Now's your chance.
But you were the main one I wanted to tell to go to hell, said Scarlet, and laughed.
Do you still want to tell me to go to hell?
Well, not as often as I used to.
Do it whenever you like, if it makes you happy.
It doesn't make me especially happy, said Scarlet. And bending, she kissed him carelessly.
His dark eyes flickered quickly over her face, hunting for something in her eyes which he did not find. And he laughed shortly. Forget about it, Lana. Forget about the old cats. I brought you to New Orleans to have fun. And I intend that you shall have it.
Part 5. Chapter 48. She did have fun. More fun than she had had since the spring before the war. New Orleans was such a strange, glamorous place, and Scarlet enjoyed it with the headlong pleasure of a pardoned life prisoner. The carpetbaggers were looting the town. Many honest folk were driven from their homes and didn't know where to look for their next meal, and a Negro sat in the lieutenant governor's chair. But the New Orleans Ret showed her was the gayest place she had ever seen. The people she met seemed to have all the money they wanted and no cares at all. Ret introduced her to dozens of women, pretty women in bright gowns, women who had soft hands that showed no signs of hard work, women who laughed at everything and never talked of stupid serious things or hard times. And the men she met, how thrilling they were! And how different from Atlanta men! And how they fought to dance with her and paid her the most extravagant compliments as though she were a young belle. These men had the same hard, reckless look Ret wore. Their eyes were always alert, like men who have lived too long with danger to be ever quite careless. They seemed to have no pasts or futures, and they politely discouraged Scarlet when, to make conversation, she asked what or where they were before they came to New Orleans. That in itself was strange, for in Atlanta every respectable newcomer hastened to present his credentials, to tell proudly of his home and family, to trace the torturous mazes of relationships that stretched over the entire South. But these men were a taciturn lot, picking their words carefully. Sometimes, when Ret was alone with them and Scarlet in the next room, she heard laughter and caught fragments of conversation that meant nothing to her, scraps of words, puzzling names. Cuba and Nassau in the blockade days, the gold rush and claim jumping, gun-running and filibustering, Nicaragua and William Walker and how he died against a wall at Trujillo. Once, her sudden entrance abruptly terminated a conversation about what had happened to the members of Quantrill's band of guerrillas, and she caught the name of Frank and Jesse James. But they were all well-mannered, beautifully tailored, and they evidently admired her, so it mattered little to Scarlet that they chose to live utterly in the present. What really mattered was that they were Rhett's friends, and had large houses and fine carriages, and they took her and Ret driving, invited them to suppers, gave parties in their honor. and Scarlet liked them very well. Rhett was amused when she told him so.
"I thought you would," he said, and laughed.
"Why not?" her suspicions aroused, as always, by his laughter.
"They're all second-raters, black sheep, rascals. They're all adventurers or carpetbag aristocrats. They all made their money speculating in food like your loving husband, or out of dubious government contracts, or in shady ways that won't bear investigation."
"I don't believe it. You're teasing. They're the nicest people."
"The nicest people in town are starving," said Rhett, "and living politely in hovels. And I doubt if I'd be received in those hovels. You see, my dear, I was engaged in some of my nefarious schemes here during the war, and these people have devilish long memories. Scarlet, you are a constant joy to me. You unerringly manage to pick the wrong people and the wrong things."
"But they are your friends."
"Oh, but I like rascals. My early youth was spent as a gambler on a riverboat, and I can understand people like that. But I'm not blind to what they are. Whereas you," he laughed again, "you have no instinct about people, no discrimination between the cheap and the great. Sometimes I think that the only great ladies you've ever associated with were your mother and Miss Melly, and neither seems to have made any impression on you."
"Melly? Why, she's as plain as an old shoe, and her clothes always look tacky, and she never has two words to say for herself."
"Spare me your jealousy, madam. Beauty doesn't make a lady, nor clothes a great lady."
"Oh, don't they? Just you wait, Rhett Butler, and I'll show you. Now that we've got money, I'm going to be the greatest lady you ever saw."
"I shall wait with interest," he said. More exciting than the people she met were the frocks Rhett bought her. Superintending the choice of colors, materials, and designs himself. Hoops were out now, and the new styles were charming with the skirts pulled back from the front and draped over bustles. And on the bustles were wreaths of flowers and bows and cascades of lace. She thought of the modest hoops of the war years, and she felt a little embarrassed at these new skirts, which undeniably outlined her abdomen. And the darling little bonnets that were not really bonnets at all, but flat little affairs worn over one eye and laden with fruits and flowers, dancing plumes and fluttering ribbons. If only Rhett had not been so silly and burned the false curls she brought to augment her knot of Indian straight hair that peaked from the rear of these little hats. And the delicate convent-made underwear. How lovely it was, and how many sets she had. Chemises and nightgowns and petticoats of the finest linen, trimmed with dainty embroidery and infinitesimal tucks. And the satin slippers Rhett bought her. They had heels 3 inches high and huge glittering paste buckles on them. And silk stockings, a dozen pairs, and not a one had cotton tops. What riches! She recklessly bought gifts for the family. A furry St. Bernard puppy for Wade, who had always longed for one. A Persian kitten for Beau. A coral bracelet for little Ella. A heavy necklace with moonstone pendants for Aunt Pitty. A complete set of Shakespeare for Melanie and Ashley. An elaborate livery for Uncle Peter, including a high silk coachman's hat with a brush upon it. Dress lengths for Dilsey and Cookie. Expensive gifts for everyone at Tara. "But what have you bought for Mammy?"
questioned Rhett, looking over the pile of gifts spread out on the bed in their hotel room, and removing the puppy and kitten to the dressing room. "Not a thing. She was hateful. Why should I bring her a present when she called us mules?"
"Why should you so resent hearing the truth, my pet? You must bring Mammy a present. It would break a heart if you didn't. And hearts like hers are too valuable to be broken."
"I won't take her a thing. She doesn't deserve it."
"Then I'll buy one.
I remember my mammy always said that when she went to heaven, she wanted a taffeta petticoat so stiff that it would stand by itself, and so rustly that the Lord God would think it was made of angels' wings. I'll buy mammy some red taffeta and have an elegant petticoat made.
She won't take it from you. She'd die rather than wear it.
I don't doubt it. But I'll make the gesture just the same. The shops of New Orleans were so rich and exciting, and shopping with Rhett was an adventure. Dining with him was an adventure, too, and one more thrilling than shopping, for he knew what to order and how it should be cooked. The wines and liqueurs and champagnes of New Orleans were new and exhilarating to her. Acquainted with only homemade blackberry and scuppernong vintages, and Aunt Pitty's swoon brandy, but oh, the food Rhett ordered. Best of all things in New Orleans was the food. Remembering the bitter, hungry days at Tara and her more recent penury, Scarlett felt that she could never eat enough of these rich dishes. Gumbos and shrimp creole, doves in wine and oysters in crumbly patties full of creamy sauce, mushrooms and sweetbreads and turkey livers, fish baked cunningly in oiled paper and limes. Her appetite never dulled, for whenever she remembered the everlasting goobers and dried peas and sweet potatoes at Tara, she felt an urge to gorge herself anew on Creole dishes. "You eat as though each meal were your last," said Rhett. "Don't scrape the plate, Scarlett. I'm sure there's more in the kitchen. You have only to ask the waiter. If you don't stop being such a glutton, you'll be as fat as the Cuban ladies, and then I shall divorce you." But she only put out her tongue at him and ordered another pastry thick with chocolate and stuffed with meringue. What fun it was to be able to spend as much money as you liked and not count pennies and feel that you should save them to pay taxes or buy mules. What fun to be with people who were gay and rich and not genteelly poor like Atlanta people. What fun to wear rustling brocade dresses that showed your waist, and all your neck and arms, and more than a little of your breast, and know that men were admiring you. And what fun to eat all you wanted without having censorious people say you weren't ladylike. And what fun to drink all the champagne you pleased. The first time she drank too much, she was embarrassed when she awoke the next morning with a splitting headache and an awful memory of singing Bonnie Blue Flag all the way back to the hotel, through the streets of New Orleans, in an open carriage. She had never seen a lady even tipsy, and the only drunken woman she had ever seen had been that waddling creature on the day when Atlanta fell. She hardly knew how to face Rhett, so great was her humiliation. But the affair seemed only to amuse him. Everything she did seemed to amuse him, as though she were a gambling kitten. It was exciting to go out with him, for he was so handsome. Somehow, she had never given his looks a thought before, and in Atlanta everyone had been too preoccupied with his shortcomings ever to talk about his appearance. But here in New Orleans, she could see how the eyes of other women followed him and how they fluttered when he bent over their hands. The realization that other women were attracted by her husband, and perhaps envied her, made her suddenly proud to be seen by his side.
"Why, we're a handsome people," thought Scarlett with pleasure. Yes, as Rhett had prophesied, marriage could be a lot of fun. Not only was it fun, but she was learning many things. That was odd in itself, because Scarlett had thought life could teach her no more. Now she felt like a child, every day on the brink of a new discovery. First, she learned that marriage with Rhett was a far different matter from marriage with either Charles or Frank. They had respected her and been afraid of her temper. They had begged for favors, and if it pleased her, she had bestowed them. Rhett didn't fear her, and she often thought didn't respect her very much either. What he wanted to do, he did, and if she didn't like it, he laughed at her. She didn't love him, but he was undoubtedly an exciting person to live with. The most exciting thing about him
was that even in his outbursts of passion, which were flavored sometimes with cruelty, sometimes with irritating amusement, he seemed always to be holding himself under restraint, always riding his emotions with a curb bit. "I guess that's because he isn't really in love with me," she thought, and was content enough with the state of affairs. "I should hate him to ever turn completely loose in any way." But still, the thought of the possibility teased her curiosity in an exciting way. Living with Rhett, she learned many new things about him, and she had thought she knew him so well. She learned that his voice could be silky as cat's fur one moment, and crisp and crackling with oaths the next. He could tell, with apparent sincerity and approval, stories of courage and honor and virtue and love in the odd places he had been, and follow them with ribald stories of coldness, cynicism. She knew no man should tell such stories to his wife, but they were entertaining, and they appealed to something coarse and earthy in her. He could be an ardent, almost a tender, lover for a brief while, and almost immediately a mocking devil who ripped the lid from her gunpowder temper, fired it, and enjoyed the explosion. She learned that his compliments were always two-edged, and his tenderest expressions open to suspicion. In fact, in those 2 weeks in New Orleans, she learned everything about him except what he really was. Some mornings, he dismissed the maid and brought her the breakfast tray himself, and fed her as though she were a child, took the hairbrush from her hand and brushed her long dark hair until it snapped and crackled. Yet other mornings she was torn rudely out of deep slumber when he snatched all the bed covers from her and tickled her bare feet. Sometimes he listened with dignified interest to details of her businesses, nodding approval at her sagacity. And at other times he called her somewhat dubious trading scavenging, highway robbery, and extortion. He took her to plays and annoyed her by whispering that God probably didn't approve of such amusements, and to churches and sotto voce, retailed funny obscenities, and then reproved her for laughing. He encouraged her to speak her mind, to be flippant and daring. She picked up from him the gift of stinging words and sardonic phrases, and learned to relish using them for the power they gave her over other people. But she didn't possess his sense of humor, which tempered his malice, nor his smile that jeered at himself, even while he was jeering at others. He made her play, and she had almost forgotten how. Life had been so serious and so bitter. He knew how to play, and swept her along with him. But he never played like a boy. He was a man, and no matter what he did, she could never forget it. She couldn't look down on him from the heights of womanly superiority, smiling as women have always smiled at the antics of men who are boys at heart. This annoyed her a little, whenever she thought of it. It would be pleasant to feel superior to Rhett. All the other men she had known she could dismiss with a half-contemptuous, "What a child!" Her father, the Tarleton twins with their love of teasing and their elaborate practical jokes, the hairy little Fontaines with their childish rages, Charles, Frank, all the men who had paid court to her during the war. Everyone, in fact. Except Ashley. Only Ashley and Rhett eluded her understanding and her control, for they were both adults, and the elements of boyishness were lacking in them. She did not understand Rhett, nor did she trouble to understand him, though there were things about him which occasionally puzzled her. There was the way he looked at her sometimes, when he thought she was unaware. Turning quickly, she frequently caught him watching her, an alert, eager, waiting look in his eyes. "Why do you look at me like that?" she once asked irritably. "Like a cat at a mouse hole." But his face had changed swiftly, and he only laughed. Soon she forgot it, and didn't puzzle her head about it any more or about anything concerning Rhett. He was too unpredictable to bother about, and life was very pleasant. Except when she thought of Ashley. Rhett kept her too busy to think of Ashley often. Ashley was hardly ever in her thoughts during the day, but at night, when she was tired from dancing, or her head was spinning from too much champagne. Then she thought of Ashley. Frequently, when she lay drowsily in Rhett's arms with the moonlight streaming over the bed, she thought how perfect life would be if it were only Ashley's arms which held her so closely. If it were only Ashley who drew her black hair across his face and wrapped it about his throat. Once when she was thinking this, she sighed and turned her head toward the window, and after a moment she felt the heavy arm beneath her neck become like iron, and Rhett's voice spoke in the stillness. "May God damn your cheating little soul to hell for all eternity." And getting up, he put on his clothes and left the room despite her startled protests and questions. He reappeared the next morning as she was breakfasting in her room, disheveled, quite drunk, and in his worst sarcastic mood, and neither made excuses nor gave an account of his absence. Scarlett asked no questions and was quite cool to him, as became an injured wife. And when she had finished the meal, she dressed under his bloodshot gaze and went shopping. He was gone when she returned, and didn't appear again until time for supper. It was a silent meal, and Scarlett's temper was straining because it was her last supper in New Orleans, and she wanted to do justice to the crawfish, and she couldn't enjoy it under his gaze. Nevertheless, she ate a large one and drank a quantity of champagne. Perhaps it was this combination that brought back her old nightmare that evening, for she awoke, cold with sweat, sobbing brokenly. She was back at Tara again, and Tara was desolate. Mother was dead, and with her all the strength and wisdom of the world. Nowhere in the world was there anyone to turn to, anyone to rely upon. And something terrifying was pursuing her, and she was running, running till her heart was bursting, running in a thick, swimming fog, crying out, blindly seeking that nameless, unknown haven of safety that was somewhere in the mist about her. Rhett was leaning over her when she woke, and without a word he picked her up in his arms like a child and held her close, his hard muscles comforting, his wordless murmuring soothing, until her sobbing ceased. "Oh, Rhett, I was so cold and so hungry and so tired, and I couldn't find it. I ran through the mist and I ran, but I couldn't find it."
"Find what, honey?"
"I don't know. I wish I did know."
"Is it your old dream?"
"Oh, yes."
He gently placed her on the bed, fumbled in the darkness and lit a candle. In the light, his face with bloodshot eyes and harsh lines was as unreadable as stone. His shirt, open to the waist, showed a brown chest covered with thick black hair. Scarlett, still shaking with fright, thought how strong and unyielding that chest was, and she whispered, "Hold me, Rhett."
"Darling," he said swiftly.
And picking her up, he sat down in a large chair, cradling her body against him.
"Oh, Rhett, it's awful to be hungry."
"It must be awful to dream of starvation after a 7-course dinner, including that enormous crawfish." He smiled, but his eyes were kind.
"Oh, Rhett, I just run and run and hunt, and I can't ever find what it is I'm hunting for. It's always hidden in the mist. I know if I could find it, I'd be safe forever and ever and never be cold or hungry again."
"Is it a person or a thing you're hunting?"
"I don't know. I never thought about it. Rhett, do you think I'll ever dream that I get there to safety?"
"No," he said, smoothing her tumbled hair.
"I don't. Dreams aren't like that. But I do think,
that if you get used to being safe and warm and well-fed in your everyday life, you'll stop dreaming that dream. And, Scarlet, I'm going to see that you are safe.
Rhett, you are so nice.
Thanks for the crumbs from your table, Mrs. Dives. Scarlet, I want you to say to yourself every morning when you wake up, I can't ever be hungry again, and nothing can ever touch me so long as Rhett is here and the United States government holds out.
The United States government?
She questioned, sitting up, startled, tears still on her cheeks.
The ex-Confederate money has now become an honest woman. I invested most of it in government bonds.
God's nutgown! Cried Scarlet, sitting up in his lap, forgetful of her recent terror. Do you mean to tell me you've loaned your money to the Yankees?
At a fair percent.
I don't care if it's 100%. You must sell them immediately. The idea of letting the Yankees have the use of your money.
And what must I do with it?
He questioned with a smile, noting that her eyes were no longer wide with fright.
Why buy property at 5 points? I'll bet you could buy all of 5 points with the money you have.
Thank you, but I wouldn't have 5 points. Now that the carpetbagger government has really gotten control of Georgia, there's no telling what may happen. I wouldn't put anything beyond the swarm of buzzards that's swooping down on Georgia now from north, east, south, and west. I'm playing along with them, you understand? As a good scallywag should do, but I don't trust them. And I'm not putting my money in real estate. I prefer bonds. You can hide them. You can't hide real estate very easily.
Do you think, she began, paling as she thought of the mills in store.
I don't know. But don't look so frightened, Scarlet. Our charming new governor is a good friend of mine. It's just that times are too uncertain now, and I don't want much of my money tied up in real estate.
He shifted her to one knee and, leaning back, reached for a cigar and lit it. She sat with her bare feet dangling, watching the play of muscles on his brown chest, her terrors forgotten.
And while we are on the subject of real estate, Scarlet, he said, I'm going to build a house. You might have bullied Frank into living in Miss Petty's house, but not me. I don't believe I could bear her vaporings 3 times a day, and moreover, I believe Uncle Peter would assassinate me before he would let me live under the sacred Hamilton roof. Miss Petty can get Miss India Wilkes to stay with her and keep the bogeyman away. When we get back to Atlanta, we are going to stay in the bridal suite of the National Hotel until our house is finished. Before we left Atlanta, I was dickering for that big lot on Peachtree, the one near the Layden house. You know the one I mean?
Oh, Rhett, how lovely. I do so want a house of my own, a great big one.
Then at last we are agreed on something. What about a white stucco with wrought iron work like these Creole houses here?
Oh, no, Rhett. Not anything old-fashioned like these New Orleans houses. I know just what I want. It's the newest thing because I saw a picture of it in, let me see, it was in that Harper's Weekly I was looking at. It was modeled after a Swiss chalet.
A Swiss what?
A chalet.
Spell it.
She complied.
Oh, he said and stroked his mustache.
It was lovely. It had a high mansard roof with a picket fence on the top and a tower made of fancy shingles at each end. And the towers had windows with red and blue glass in them. It was so stylish looking.
I suppose it had jigsaw work on the porch banisters?
Yes.
And a fringe of wooden scroll work hanging from the roof of the porch?
Yes. You must have seen one like it.
I have, but not in Switzerland. The Swiss are a very intelligent race and keenly alive to architectural beauty. Do you really want a house like that?
Oh, yes.
I had hoped that association with me might improve your taste. Why not a Creole house or a colonial with 6 white columns?
I tell you, I don't want anything tacky and old-fashioned looking. And inside, let's have red wallpaper and red velvet portieres over all the folding doors and, oh, lots of expensive walnut furniture and grand thick carpets and... Oh, Rhett, everybody will be pea green when they see our house.
It's very necessary that everyone shall be envious. Well, if you like, they shall be green.
But, Scarlet, has it occurred to you that it's hardly in good taste to furnish the house on so lavish a scale when everyone is so poor?
I want it that way, she said obstinately. I want to make everybody who's been mean to me feel bad. And we'll get big receptions that'll make the whole town wish they hadn't said such nasty things.
But who will come to our receptions?
Well, everybody, of course.
I doubt it. The old guard dies, but it never surrenders.
Oh, Rhett, how you run on. If you got money, people always like you.
Not Southerners. It's harder for speculators' money to get into the best parlors than for a camel to go through the needle's eye. And as for scallywags, that's you and me, my pet. We'll be lucky if we aren't spit upon. But if you'd like to try, I'll back you, my dear. And I'm sure I shall enjoy your campaign intensely. And while we're on the subject of money, let me make this clear to you. You can have all the cash you want for the house and all you want for your fal-lals. And if you like jewelry, you can have it. But I'm going to pick it out. You have such execrable taste, my pet. And anything you want for Wade or Ella... And if Will Benteen can't make a go of the cotton, I'm willing to chip in and help out on that white elephant in Clayton County that you love so much. That's fair enough, isn't it?
Of course. You're very generous. But listen closely.
Not 1 cent for the store. And not 1 cent for that kindling factory of yours.
Oh, said Scarlet, her face falling.
All during the honeymoon, she had been thinking how she could bring up the subject of the $1,000 she needed to buy 50 feet more of land to enlarge her lumber yard.
I thought you always bragged about being broad-minded and not caring what people said about my running a business. And you're just like every other man. So afraid people will say I wear the pants in the family.
There's never going to be any doubt in anybody's mind about who wears the pants in the Butler family, drawled Rhett. I don't care what fools say. In fact, I'm ill-bred enough to be proud of having a smart wife. I want you to keep on running the store and the mills. They're your children's. When Wade grows up, he won't feel right about being supported by his stepfather, and then he can take over the management. But not 1 cent of mine goes into either business.
Why?
Because I don't care to contribute to the support of Ashley Wilkes.
Are you going to begin that again?
No, but you asked my reasons, and I have given them. And another thing, don't think you can juggle books on me and lie about how much your clothes cost and how much it takes to run the house so that you can use the money to buy more mules or another mill for Ashley. I intend to look over and carefully check your expenditures, and I know what things cost. Oh, don't get insulted. You'd do it. I wouldn't put it beyond you. In fact, I wouldn't put anything beyond you where either Tara or Ashley is concerned. I don't mind Tara. But I must draw the line at Ashley. I'm riding you with a slack rein, my pet. But don't forget that I'm riding with curb and spurs, just the same.
Chapter 49 Mrs. Elsing cocked her ear toward the hall. Hearing Melanie's steps die away into the kitchen where rattling dishes and clinking silverware gave promise of refreshments, she turned and spoke softly to the ladies who sat in a circle in the parlor, their sewing baskets in their laps.
"Personally, I do not intend to call on Scarlet now or ever," she said, the chill elegance of her face colder than usual.
The other members of the ladies' sewing circle for the widows and orphans of the Confederacy eagerly laid down their needles and edged their rocking chairs closer. All the ladies had been bursting to discuss Scarlet and Rhett, but Melanie's presence prevented it. Just the day before, the couple had returned from New Orleans and they were occupying the bridal suite at the National Hotel.
"Hugh says that I must call out of courtesy for the way Captain Butler saved his life," Mrs. Elsing continued. "And poor Fanny sides with him, and says she will call, too. I said to her, 'Fanny,' I said, 'if it wasn't for Scarlet, Tommy would be alive this minute. It's an insult to his memory to call.' And Fanny had no better sense than to say, 'Mother, I'm not calling on Scarlet, I'm calling on Captain Butler.' He tried his best to save Tommy, and it wasn't his fault if he failed."
"How silly young people are," said Mrs. Merriweather. "Call, indeed."
Her stout bosom swelled indignantly as she remembered Scarlet's rude reception of her advice on marrying Rhett.
"My Maybelle is just as silly as your Fanny. She says she and Renee will call because Captain Butler kept Renee from getting hanged. And I said if it hadn't been for Scarlet exposing herself, Renee would never have been in any danger. And Father Merriweather intends to call, and he talks like he was in his dotage, and says he's grateful to that scoundrel, even if I'm not. I vow, since Father Merriweather was in that Watling creature's house, he has acted in a disgraceful way. Call, indeed! I certainly shan't call. Scarlet has outlawed herself by marrying such a man. He was bad enough when he was a speculator during the war, and making money out of our hunger. But now that he is hand in glove with the carpetbaggers and scalawags, and a friend, actually a friend of that odious wretch, Governor Bullock. Call, indeed!"
Mrs. Bunnell sighed. She was a plump brown wren of a woman with a cheerful face.
"They'll only call once for courtesy, Dolly. I don't know that I blame them. I've heard that all the men who were out that night intend to call, and I think they should. Somehow, it's hard for me to think that Scarlet is her mother's child. I went to school with Ellen Robillard in Savannah, and there was never a lovelier girl than she was, and she was very dear to me. If only her father had not opposed her match with her cousin Philippe Robillard. There was nothing really wrong with the boy. Boys must sow their wild oats. But Ellen must run off and marry old man O'Hara and have a daughter like Scarlet. But really, I feel that I must call once out of memory to Ellen."
"Sentimental nonsense," snorted Mrs. Merriweather with vigor. "Kitty Bunnell, are you going to call on a woman who married a bare year after her husband's death? A woman—"
"And she really killed Mr. Kennedy," interrupted India. Her voice was cool but acid.
Whenever she thought of Scarlet, it was hard for her even to be polite, remembering, always remembering Stuart Tarleton.
"And I have always thought that there was more between her and that butler man before Mr. Kennedy was killed than most people suspected."
Before the ladies could recover from their shocked astonishment at her statement, and at a spinster mentioning such a matter, Melanie was standing in the doorway. So engrossed had they been in their gossip that they had not heard her light tread, and now, confronted by their hostess, they looked like whispering schoolgirls caught by a teacher. Alarm was added to consternation at the change in Melanie's face. She was pink with righteous anger, her gentle eyes snapping fire, her nostrils quivering. No one had ever seen Melanie angry before. Not a lady present thought her capable of wrath. They all loved her, but they thought her the sweetest, most pliable of young women, deferential to her elders and without any opinions of her own.
"How dare you, India?" she questioned in a low voice that shook. "Where will your jealousy lead you? For shame!"
India's face went white, but her head was high.
I retract nothing, she said briefly.
But her mind was seething.
Jealous, am I? She thought. With the memory of Stuart Tarleton and of Honey and Charles. Didn't she have good reason to be jealous of Scarlet? Didn't she have good reason to hate her, especially now that she had a suspicion that Scarlet had somehow entangled Ashley in her web? She thought, there's plenty I could tell you about Ashley and your precious Scarlet. India was torn between the desire to shield Ashley by her silence and to extricate him by telling all her suspicions to Melanie and the whole world. That would force Scarlet to release whatever hold she had on Ashley. But this was not the time. She had nothing definite, only suspicions. I retract nothing, she repeated.
Then it is fortunate that you are no longer living under my roof, said Melanie, and her words were cold. India leaped to her feet, red flooding her sallow face.
Melanie, you... my sister-in-law. You aren't going to quarrel with me over that fast piece.
Scarlet is my sister-in-law, too, said Melanie, meeting India's eyes squarely as though they were strangers, and dearer to me than any blood sister could ever be. If you are so forgetful of my favors at her hands, I am not. She stayed with me through the whole siege when she could have gone home, when even Aunt Pity had run away to Macon. She brought my baby for me when the Yankees were almost in Atlanta. And she burdened herself with me and Beau all that dreadful trip to Tara when she could have left me here in a hospital for the Yankees to get me. And she nursed and fed me, even if she was tired. And even if she went hungry, because I was sick and weak, I had the best mattress at Tara. When I could walk, I had the only whole pair of shoes. You can forget those things she did for me, India, but I cannot. And when Ashley came home sick, discouraged, without a home, without a cent in his pockets, she took him in like a sister. And when we thought we would have to go north and it was breaking our hearts to leave Georgia, Scarlet stepped in and gave him the mill to run. And Captain Butler saved Ashley's life out of the kindness of his heart. Certainly Ashley had no claim on him. And I am grateful. Grateful to Scarlet and to Captain Butler. But you, India, how can you forget the favors Scarlet has done me and Ashley? How can you hold your brother's life so cheap as to cast slurs on the man who saved him? If you went down on your knees to Captain Butler and Scarlet, it would not be enough.
Now, Melly, began Mrs. Merriweather briskly, for she had recovered her composure. That's no way to talk to India.
I heard what you said about Scarlet, too, cried Melanie, swinging on the stout old lady with the air of a duelist who, having withdrawn a blade from one prostrate opponent, turns hungrily toward another. And you too, Mrs. Elsing. What you think of her in your own petty minds, I do not care, for that is your business. But what you say about her in my own house or in my own hearing ever is my business. But how can you even think such dreadful things, much less say them? Are your men so cheap to you that you would rather see them dead than alive? Have you no gratitude to the man who saved them, and saved them at risk of his own life? The Yankees might easily have thought him a member of the clan if the whole truth had come out. They might have hanged him. But he risked himself for your men, for your father-in-law, Mrs. Merriweather, and your son-in-law, and your two nephews, too, and your brother, Mrs. Bunnell, and your son and son-in-law, Mrs. Elsing. Ingrates, that's what you are. I ask an apology from all of you. Mrs. Elsing was on her feet, cramming her sewing into her box, her mouth set. If anyone had ever told me that you could be so ill-bred, Melly. No, I will not apologize. India is right. Scarlet is a flighty, fast bit of baggage. I can't forget how she acted during the war, and I can't forget how poor, white, trashy she's acted since she got a little money. What you can't forget, cut in Melanie, clenching her small fists against her sides. Is that she demoted Hugh because he wasn't smart enough to run her mill?
Melly,
moaned a chorus of voices. Mrs. Elsing's head jerked up, and she started toward the door. With her hand on the knob of the front door, she stopped and turned.
"Melly," she said, and her voice softened. "Honey, this breaks my heart. I was your mother's best friend, and I helped Dr. Meade bring you into this world. And I've loved you like you were mine. If it was something that mattered, it wouldn't be so hard to hear you talk like this. But about a woman like Scarlett O'Hara, who just as soon do you a dirty turn as the next of us."
Tears had started in Melanie's eyes at the first words Mrs. Elsing spoke. But her face hardened when the old lady had finished.
"I want it understood," she said, "that any of you who do not call on Scarlett need never, never call on me."
There was a loud murmur of voices, confusion as the ladies got to their feet. Mrs. Elsing dropped her sewing box on the floor and came back into the room, her false fringe jerking awry.
"I won't have it," she cried. "I won't have it. You are beside yourself, Melly, and I don't hold you responsible. You shall be my friend, and I shall be yours. I refuse to let this come between us."
She was crying, and somehow Melanie was in her arms crying too, but declaring between sobs that she meant every word she said. Several of the other ladies burst into tears, and Mrs. Merriweather, trumpeting loudly into her handkerchief, embraced both Mrs. Elsing and Melanie. Aunt Pity, who had been a petrified witness to the whole scene, suddenly slid to the floor in what was one of the few real fainting spells she had ever had. Amid the tears and confusion and kissing and scurrying for smelling salts and brandy, there was only one calm face, one dry pair of eyes. India Wilkes took her departure unnoticed by anyone. Grandpa Merriweather, meeting Uncle Henry Hamilton in the Girl of the Period saloon several hours later, related the happenings of the morning which he had heard from Mrs. Merriweather. He told it with relish, for he was delighted that someone had the courage to face down his redoubtable daughter-in-law. Certainly, he had never had the courage.
"Well, what did the pack of silly fools finally decide to do?"
asked Uncle Henry irritably.
"I don't know for sure," said Grandpa. "But it looks to me like Melly won hands down on this go-round.
I'll bet they'll all call at least once. Folks set a store by that niece of yours, Henry.
Melly's a fool and the ladies are right.
Scarlett is a slick piece of baggage, and I don't see why Charlie ever married her," said Uncle Henry gloomily. "But Melly was right, too, in a way. It's only decent that the families of the men Captain Butler saved should call. When you come right down to it, I haven't got so much against Butler. He showed himself a fine man that night he saved our hides. It's Scarlett who sticks under my tail like a cockle-burr. She's a sight too smart for her own good. Well, I've got to call. Scalawag or not, Scarlett is my niece by marriage, after all. I was aiming to call this afternoon. I'll go with you, Henry. Dolly will be fit to be tied when she hears I've gone. Wait till I get one more drink."
"No, we'll get a drink off Captain Butler. I'll say this for him. He always has good liquor."
Rhett had said that the old guard would never surrender, and he was right. He knew how little significance there was to the few calls made upon them, and he knew why the calls were made. The families of the men who had been in the ill-starred clan foray did call at first, but called with obvious infrequency thereafter. And they did not invite the Rhett Butlers to their homes. Rhett said they would not have come at all except for fear of violence at the hands of Melanie. Where he got this idea, Scarlett didn't know, but she dismissed it with the contempt it deserved. For what possible influence could Melanie have on people like Mrs. Elsing and Mrs. Merriweather? That they didn't call again worried her very little. In fact, their absence was hardly noticed,
for her suite was crowded with guests of another type. New people, established Atlanteans called them, when they were not calling them something less polite. There were many new people staying at the National Hotel who, like Rhett and Scarlet, were waiting for their houses to be completed. There were gay, wealthy people, very much like Rhett's New Orleans friends, elegant of dress, free with their money, vague as to their antecedents. All the men were Republicans and were in Atlanta on business connected with the state government. Just what the business was, Scarlet didn't know, and didn't trouble to learn. Rhett could have told her exactly what it was, the same business that buzzards have with dying animals. They smelled death from afar and were drawn unerringly to it, to gorge themselves. Government of Georgia, by its own citizens, was dead. The state was helpless, and the adventurers were swarming in. The wives of Rhett Scalawag and carpetbagger friends called in droves, and so did the new people she had met when she sold lumber for their homes. Rhett said that having done business with them, she should receive them, and having received them, she found them pleasant company. They wore lovely clothes and never talked about the war or hard times, but confined their conversation to fashions, scandals, and whist. Scarlet had never played cards before, and she took to whist with joy, becoming a good player in a short time. Whenever she was at the hotel, there was a crowd of whist players in her suite. But she was not often in her suite these days, for she was too busy with the building of her new house to be bothered with callers. These days, she didn't much care whether she had callers or not. She wanted to delay her social activities until the day when the house was finished, and she could emerge as the mistress of Atlanta's largest mansion, the hostess of the town's most elaborate entertainments. Through the long, warm days, she watched her red stone and gray shingle house rise grandly, to tower above any other house on Peachtree Street. Forgetful of the store and the mills, she spent her time on the lot, arguing with carpenters, bickering with masons, harrying the contractor. As the walls went swiftly up, she thought with satisfaction that when finished, it would be larger and finer looking than any other house in town. It would be even more imposing than the nearby James residence, which had just been purchased for the official mansion of Governor Bullock. The governor's mansion was brave with jigsaw work on banisters and eaves, but the intricate scroll work on Scarlet's house put the mansion to shame. The mansion had a ballroom, but it looked like a billiard table compared with the enormous room that covered the entire third floor of Scarlet's house. In fact, her house had more of everything than the mansion, or any other house in town for that matter. More cupolas and turrets, and towers and balconies and lightning rods, and far more windows with colored panes. A veranda encircled the entire house, and four flights of steps on the four sides of the building led up to it. The yard was wide and green, and scattered about it were rustic iron benches, an iron summer house, fashionably called a gazebo, which Scarlet had been assured was of pure Gothic design, and two large iron statues, one a stag, and the other a mastiff as large as a Shetland pony. To Wade and Ella, a little dazzled by the size, splendor, and fashionable dark gloom of their new home, these two metal animals were the only cheerful notes. Within, the house was furnished as Scarlet had desired, with thick red carpeting which ran from wall to wall. Red velvet portieres, and the newest of highly varnished black walnut furniture, carved wherever there was an inch for carving, and upholstered in such slick horsehair that ladies had to deposit themselves thereon with great care for fear of sliding off. Everywhere on the walls were gilt-framed mirrors and long pier glasses, as many, Rhett said idly, as there were in Belle Watling's establishment. Interspersed were steel engravings in heavy frames, some of them 8 feet long, which Scarlet had ordered especially from New York. The walls were covered with rich, dark paper. The ceilings were high, and the house was always dim, for the windows were overdraped with plum-colored plush hangings that shut out most of the sunlight. All in all, it was an establishment to take one's breath away. And Scarlet, stepping on the soft carpets and sinking into the embrace of the deep feather beds, remembered the cold floors and the straw-stuffed bed-ticks of Tara, and was satisfied. She thought it the most beautiful and most elegantly furnished house she had ever seen. But Rhett said it was a nightmare. However, if it made her happy, she was welcome to it. "A stranger without being told a word about us would know this house was built with ill-gotten gains," he said. "You know, Scarlet, money ill come by never comes to good, and this house is proof of the axiom. It's just the kind of house a profiteer would build." But Scarlet, abrim with pride and happiness and full of plans for the entertainment she would give when they were thoroughly settled in the house, only pinched his ear playfully and said, "Fiddle-dee-dee, how you do run on." She knew by now that Rhett loved to take her down a peg, and would spoil her fun whenever he could if she lent an attentive ear to his jibes. Should she take him seriously, she would be forced to quarrel with him. And she didn't care to match swords, for she always came off second best. So she hardly ever listened to anything he said. And what she was forced to hear, she tried to turn off as a joke. At least, she tried for a while. During their honeymoon, and for the greater part of their stay at the National Hotel, they had lived together with amiability. But scarcely had they moved into the new house, and Scarlet gathered her new friends about her, when sudden sharp quarrels sprang up between them. They were brief quarrels, short-lived because it was impossible to keep a quarrel going with Rhett, who remained coolly indifferent to her hot words and waited his chance to pink her in an unguarded spot. She quarreled. Rhett did not. He only stated his unequivocal opinion of herself, her actions, her house, and her new friends. And some of his opinions were of such a nature that she could no longer ignore them and treat them as jokes. For instance, when she decided to change the name of Kennedy's General Store to something more edifying, she asked him to think of a title that would include the word emporium. Rhett suggested Caveat Emptorium, assuring her that it would be a title most in keeping with the type of goods sold in the store. She thought it had an imposing sound, and even went so far as to have the sign painted when Ashley Wilkes, embarrassed, translated the real meaning,
and Rhett had roared at her rage.
And there was the way he treated Mammy. Mammy had never yielded an inch from her stand that Rhett was a mule in horse harness. She was polite but cold to Rhett. She always called him Captain Butler, never Mr. Rhett. She never even dropped a curtsy when Rhett presented her with a red petticoat, and she never wore it, either. She kept Ella and Wade out of Rhett's way whenever she could, despite the fact that Wade adored Uncle Rhett, and Rhett was obviously fond of the boy. But instead of discharging Mammy, or being short and stern with her, Rhett treated her with the utmost deference, with far more courtesy than he treated any of the ladies of Scarlet's recent acquaintance. In fact, with more courtesy than he treated Scarlet herself. He always asked Mammy's permission to take Wade riding and consulted her before he bought Ella dolls, and Mammy was hardly polite to him. Scarlet felt that Rhett should be firm with Mammy, as became the head of the house. But Rhett only laughed and said that Mammy was the real head of the house. He infuriated Scarlet by saying coolly that he was preparing to be very sorry for her some years hence, when the Republican rule was gone from Georgia and the Democrats back in power. When the Democrats get a governor and a legislature of their own, all your new vulgar Republican friends will be wiped off the chessboard and sent back to minding bars and emptying slops where they belong. And you'll be left out on the end of a limb, with never a Democratic friend or a Republican either. Well, take no thought of the morrow. Scarlett laughed, and with some justice, for at that time Bullock was safe in the governor's chair. 27 Negroes were in the legislature, and thousands of the Democratic voters of Georgia were disfranchised. The Democrats will never get back. All they do is make the Yankees madder and put off the day when they could get back. All they do is talk big and run around at night, Ku Kluxing. They will get back. I know Southerners. I know Georgians. They're a tough and a bullheaded lot. If they've got to fight another war to get back, they'll fight another war. If they've got to buy black votes like the Yankees have done, they will buy black votes. If they've got to vote 10,000 dead men like the Yankees did, every corpse in every cemetery in Georgia will be at the polls. Things are going to get so bad under the benign rule of our good friend Rufus Bullock that Georgia is going to vomit him up.
Rhett, don't use such vulgar words, cried Scarlett. You talk like I wouldn't be glad to see the Democrats come back. And you know that isn't so. I'd be very glad to see them back. Do you think I like to see these soldiers hanging around, reminding me of... Do you think I like... Well, I'm a Georgian, too. I'd like to see the Democrats get back. But they won't. Not ever. And even if they did, how would that affect my friends? They'd still have their money, wouldn't they?
If they kept their money. But I doubt the ability of any of them to keep money more than 5 years at the rate they're spending. Easy come, easy go. Their money won't do them any good. Any more than my money has done you any good. It certainly hasn't made a horse out of you yet, has it, my pretty mule? The quarrel which sprang from this last remark lasted for days. After the fourth day of Scarlett's sulks and obvious silent demands for an apology, Rhett went to New Orleans, taking Wade with him, over Mammy's protests, and he stayed away until Scarlett's tantrum had passed. But the sting of not humbling him remained with her. When he came back from New Orleans, cool and bland, she swallowed her anger as best she could, pushing it into the back of her mind, to be thought of at some later date. She didn't want to bother with anything unpleasant now. She wanted to be happy, for her mind was full of the first party she would give in the new house. It would be an enormous night reception with palms and an orchestra and all the porches shrouded in canvas and a collation that made her mouth water in anticipation. To it she intended to invite everyone she had ever known in Atlanta, all the old friends and all the new and charming ones she had met since returning from her honeymoon. The excitement of the party banished, for the most part, the memory of Rhett's barbs, and she was happy. Happier than she had been in years, as she planned her reception. Oh, what fun it was to be rich! To give parties and never count the cost. To buy the most expensive furniture and dresses and food and never think about the bills. How marvelous to be able to send tidy checks to Aunt Pauline and Aunt Eulalie in Charleston and to Will at Tara. Oh, the jealous fools who said money wasn't everything. How perverse of Rhett to say that it had done nothing for her. Scarlett issued cards of invitation to all her friends and acquaintances, old and new, even those she didn't like. She didn't accept even Mrs. Merriweather, who had been almost rude when she called on her at the National Hotel, or Mrs. Elsing, who had been cool to frigidness. She invited Mrs. Meade and Mrs. Whiting, who she knew disliked her, and who she knew would be embarrassed because they didn't have the proper clothes to wear to so elegant a function.
for Scarlet's housewarming, or crush, as it was fashionable to call such evening parties, half-reception, half-ball, was by far the most elaborate affair Atlanta had ever seen. That night the house and canvas-covered veranda were filled with guests who drank her champagne punch and ate her patties and creamed oysters and danced to the music of the orchestra that was carefully screened by a wall of palms and rubber plants. But none of those whom Rhett had termed the old guard were present, except Melanie and Ashley, Aunt Pitty and Uncle Henry, Dr. and Mrs. Meade and Grandpa Merriweather. Many of the old guard had reluctantly decided to attend the crush. Some had accepted because of Melanie's attitude, others because they felt they owed Rhett a debt for saving their lives and those of their relatives. But 2 days before the function, a rumor went about Atlanta that Governor Bullock had been invited. The old guard signified their disapproval by a sheaf of cards, regretting their inability to accept Scarlett's kind invitation. And the small group of old friends who did attend took their departure, embarrassed but firm, as soon as the governor entered Scarlett's house. Scarlett was so bewildered and infuriated at these slights that the party was utterly ruined for her. Her elegant crush. She had planned it so lovingly, and so few old friends and no old enemies had been there to see how wonderful it was. After the last guest had gone home at dawn, she would have cried and stormed had she not been afraid that Rhett would roar with laughter, afraid that she would read "I told you so" in his dancing black eyes, even if he didn't speak the words. So she swallowed her wrath with poor grace and pretended indifference. Only to Melanie, the next morning, did she permit herself the luxury of exploding. "You insulted me, Melly Wilkes, and you made Ashley and the others insult me. You know they'd never have gone home so soon if you hadn't dragged them. Oh, I saw you. Just when I started to bring Governor Bullock over to present him to you, you ran like a rabbit. I did not believe, I could not believe that he would really be present," answered Melanie unhappily, "even though everybody said..." "Everybody? So everybody's been clacking and blabbing about me, have they?" cried Scarlett furiously. "Do you mean to tell me that if you'd known the governor was going to be present, you wouldn't have come either?" "No," said Melanie in a low voice, her eyes on the floor. "Darling, I just couldn't have come." "Great balls of fire! So you'd have insulted me like everybody else did." "Oh, mercy," cried Melly in real distress. "I didn't mean to hurt you. You're my own sister, darling, and my own Charlie's widow, and I..." She put a timid hand on Scarlett's arm, but Scarlett flung it off, wishing fervently that she could roar as loudly as Gerald used to roar when in a temper. But Melanie faced her wrath, and as she looked into Scarlett's stormy green eyes, her slight shoulders straightened and a mantle of dignity, strangely at variance with her childish face and figure, fell upon her. "I'm sorry you're hurt, my dear, but I cannot meet Governor Bullock or any Republican or any scallywag. I will not meet them in your house or any other house. No, not even if I have to... if I have to..." Melanie cast about for the worst thing she could think of. "Not even if I have to be rude." "Are you criticizing my friends?" "No, dear. But they are your friends and not mine." "Are you criticizing me for having the governor at my house?" Cornered, Melanie still met Scarlett's eyes unwaveringly. "Darling, what you do, you always do for a good reason, and I love you and trust you, and it is not for me to criticize, and I will not permit anyone to criticize you in my hearing. But, oh,
Scarlet!
Suddenly words began to bubble out, swift, hot words, and there was an inflexible hate in the low voice. Can you forget what these people did to us? Can you forget darling Charlie dead and Ashley's health ruined and 12 Oaks burned? Oh, Scarlet, you can't forget that terrible man you shot with your mother's sewing box in his hands. You can't forget Sherman's men at Terra, and how they even stole our underwear, and tried to burn the place down and actually handled my father's sword. Oh, Scarlet, it was these same people who robbed us and tortured us and left us to starve that you invited to your party. The same people who have set the darkies up to lord it over us, who are robbing us and keeping our men from voting. I can't forget. I won't forget. I won't let my beau forget. And I'll teach my grandchildren to hate these people, and my grandchildren's grandchildren if God lets me live that long. Scarlet, how can you forget? Melanie paused for breath, and Scarlet stared at her, startled out of her own anger by the quivering note of violence in Melanie's voice. Do you think I'm a fool? She questioned impatiently. Of course I remember. But all that's past, Melly. It's up to us to make the best of things, and I'm trying to do it. Governor Bullock and some of the nicer Republicans can help us a lot if we handle them right. There are no nice Republicans, said Melanie flatly. And I don't want their help, and I don't intend to make the best of things, if they are Yankee things. Good heaven, Melly! Why get in such a pet? Oh, cried Melanie, looking conscience-stricken. How I have run on! Scarlet, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings or to criticize. Everybody thinks differently, and everybody's got a right to their own opinion. Now, dear, I love you, and you know I love you, and nothing you could ever do would make me change. And you still love me, don't you? I haven't made you hate me, have I? Scarlet, I couldn't stand it if anything ever came between us. After all we've been through together. Say it's all right. Fiddle-dee-dee, Melly, what a tempest you make in a teapot, said Scarlet grudgingly. But she didn't throw off the hand that stole around her waist. Now, we're all right again, said Melanie pleasedly. But she added softly, I want us to visit each other just like we always did, darling. Just, you let me know what days Republicans and scalawags are coming to see you, and I'll stay home on those days. It's a matter of supreme indifference to me whether you come or not, said Scarlet, putting on her bonnet and going home in a huff. There was some satisfaction to her wounded vanity in the hurt look on Melanie's face. In the weeks that followed her first party, Scarlet was hard put to keep up her pretense of supreme indifference to public opinion. When she didn't receive calls from old friends, except Melanie and Pitty and Uncle Henry and Ashley, and didn't get cards to their modest entertainments, she was genuinely puzzled and hurt. Had she not gone out of her way to bury old hatchets and show these people that she bore them no ill will for their gossiping and backbiting? Surely they must know that she didn't like Governor Bullock any more than they did, but that it was expedient to be nice to him. The idiots! If everybody would be nice to the Republicans, Georgia would get out of the fix she was in very quickly. She didn't realize then that with one stroke she had cut forever any fragile tie that still bound her to the old days, to old friends. Not even Melanie's influence could repair the break of that gossamer thread. And Melanie, bewildered, broken-hearted but still loyal, didn't try to repair it. Even had Scarlet wanted to turn back to old ways, old friends, there was no turning back possible now. The face of the town was set against her as stonily as granite,
The hate that enveloped the Bullock regime enveloped her, too, a hate that had little fire and fury in it, but much cold implacability. Scarlet had cast her lot with the enemy, and whatever her birth and family connections, she was now in the category of a turncoat, a nigger lover, a traitor, a Republican, and a scalawag. After a miserable while, Scarlet's pretended indifference gave way to the real thing.
She had never been one to worry long over the vagaries of human conduct, or to be cast down for long if one line of action failed.
Soon she didn't care what the Merryweathers, the Elsings, the Whitings, the Bunnells, the Meads, and the others thought of her. At least Melanie called, bringing Ashley. And Ashley was the one who mattered the most. And there were other people in Atlanta who would come to her parties. Other people far more congenial than those hide-bound old hens. Any time she wanted to fill her house with guests, she could do so. And these guests would be far more entertaining, far more handsomely dressed than those prissy, straight-laced old fools who disapproved of her. These people were newcomers to Atlanta. Some of them were acquaintances of Rhett, some associated with him in those mysterious affairs which he referred to as mere business, my pet. Some were couples Scarlet had met when she was living at the National Hotel, and some were Governor Bullock's appointees. The set with which she was now moving was a motley crew. Among them were the Gellerts, who had lived in a dozen different states, and who apparently had left each one hastily upon detection of their swindling schemes. The Conningtons, whose connection with the Freedmen's Bureau in a distant state had been highly lucrative at the expense of the ignorant blacks they were supposed to protect. The Deals, who had sold cardboard shoes to the Confederate government until it became necessary for them to spend the last year of the war in Europe. The Hundens, who had police records in many cities, but nevertheless were often successful bidders on state contracts. The Carahans, who had gotten their start in a gambling house, and now were gambling for bigger stakes in the building of non-existent railroads with the state's money. The Flahertys, who had bought salt at 1 cent a pound in 1861, and made a fortune when salt went to 50 cents in 1863. And the Barts, who had owned the largest brothel in a northern metropolis during the war, and now were moving in the best circles of carpetbagger society. Such people were Scarlet's intimates now. But those who attended her larger receptions included others of some culture and refinement, many of excellent families. In addition to the carpetbag gentry, substantial people from the North were moving into Atlanta, attracted by the never-ceasing business activity of the town in this period of rebuilding and expansion. Yankee families of wealth sent young sons to the South to pioneer on the new frontier, and Yankee officers, after their discharge, took up permanent residence in the town they had fought so hard to capture. At first, strangers in a strange town, they were glad to accept invitations to the lavish entertainments of the wealthy and hospitable Mrs. Butler. But they soon drifted out of her set. They were good people, and they needed only a short acquaintance with carpetbaggers and carpetbag rule to become as resentful of them as the native Georgians were. Many became Democrats, and more Southern than the Southerners. Other misfits in Scarlet's circle remained there only because they were not welcome elsewhere. They would have much preferred the quiet parlors of the old guard, but the old guard would have none of them. Among these were the Yankee schoolmarms who had come south imbued with a desire to uplift the Negro, and the scalawags who had been born good Democrats, but had turned Republican after the surrender. It was hard to say which class was more cordially hated by the settled citizenry, the impractical Yankee schoolmarms or the scalawags, but the balance probably fell with the latter. The schoolmarms could be dismissed with, Well, what can you expect of nigger-loving Yankees? Of course they think the nigger is just as good as they are. But for those Georgians who had turned Republican for personal gain, there was no excuse. Starving is good enough for us. It ought to be good enough for you, was the way the old guard felt. Many ex-Confederate soldiers, knowing the frantic fear of men who saw their families in want, were more tolerant of former comrades who had changed political colors in order that their families might eat. But not the women of the old guard. And the women were the implacable and inflexible power behind the social throne. The lost cause was stronger, dearer now in their hearts than it had ever been at the height of its glory. It was a fetish now. Everything about it was sacred. The graves of the men who had died for it, the battlefields, the torn flags, the crossed sabers in their halls, the fading letters from the front, the veterans. These women gave no aid, comfort, or quarter to the late enemy. And now Scarlet was numbered among the enemy. In this mongrel society thrown together by the exigencies of the political situation, there was but one thing in common. That was money. As most of them had never had $25 at one time in their whole lives, previous to the war, they were now embarked on an orgy of spending such as Atlanta had never seen before. With the Republicans in the political saddle, the town entered into an era of waste and ostentation, with the trappings of refinement thinly veneering the vice and vulgarity beneath. Never before had the cleavage of the very rich and the very poor been so marked. Those on top took no thought for those less fortunate. Except for the Negroes, of course. They must have the very best. The best of schools and lodgings and clothes and amusements, for they were the power in politics, and every Negro